This is Swan.
I'm Chris.
And you're listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. Brooklyn.
New pronunciation.
Yeah, everything's changing this week. But I'm excited we have one of Chris's good friends, Evio Isaac, on the show. I just got done stalking you on the internet, so this will be exciting. You're an architect and designer and photographer, alumni of Middlebury, Rice University, native of New York and currently living in Texas. All true?
All true.
Anything else we need to know about you?
I think that's a good place to start.
Okay, great. Yeah. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So we were talking about how it could be fun to talk a little bit about maybe some of the intersections between architecture and literary worlds. So listeners can look forward to that. Before we get rolling into that, I want to do our little river writing segment. So this is a writing prompt seated in poetry, train of thought, you know, messy spelling errors, whatever, like there's no wrong way to do it. You just keep flowing, pen in the page. If you run out of things to say, you can revisit the thought that got sparked, or you can say, you know, what I really want to say is blank, or you can just say, even I don't know what to write. A lot of writers do that, you know, just writing to write. So the poem we used this week was called Improvement, and it's by Danusha Lamiris. And I don't know why, but I read it and I was like, yeah, for some reason I like this. It seems appropriate for like the changing season to kind of reflect on, I don't know, circumstances, I suppose. The optometrist says my eyes are getting better each year. Soon he'll have to lower my prescription. What's next? The light step I had at 6. All the gray hairs back to brown. Skin taut as a drum. My improved eyes and I walked around town and celebrated. We took in the letters of the marquee, the individual leaves, filling out the branches of the sycamore. An early moon. So much goes downhill. Our joints wearing out with every mile, the delicate folds of the eardrum exhausted from years of listening. I'm grateful for small victories, the way the heart still beats time in the cathedral of the ribs, and the mind watching its parade of thoughts enter and leave begins to see them for what they are, jugglers, fire swallowers, acrobats, tossing their batons in the air. So kind of a strange one.
A good one.
I noticed we all kind of paused after, and we're like, okay, find a spot to write. So I'll open it up. Would either of you care to read what you wrote?
I can start.
Thanks, Chris.
Sure. Let's see. Aging is always depicted negatively. Yes, your body isn't what it used to be, but maybe there's some benefits to that. A need for glasses means you'll pay more attention to what you see. Weaker legs means you can't just rush through the streets hurrying to everything. As your body slows down, enjoy the ability to see the world in a brand new light. What you find will more than compensate for everything you've lost. It's a gift to be alive, and nothing can take that away from you.
Thank you. Evio, any interest in reading?
Sure. I started with a list. I picked up on a few key phrases or ideas. So I'll go through those first. One of the things that stuck out to me was the description of this kind of spatial quality of the chest as a cathedral of the ribs. And then overall, I think the poem conjured a kind of sense of the autonomy of body parts. And then there was a sort of personification of each body part within the body. So what I wrote was, the body is imagined as an aggregation of autonomous pieces, and the sum of these pieces is never claimed. The narrator, protagonist, is kept separate from the subject, the eyes, etc. And then I kind of expanded on the spatial qualities of the body. The use of architecture as a metaphor to describe the magnitude of the particular region of the body, its role, its value, and the way the author feels about the chest are all wrapped up in the metaphor of the cathedral.
Thank you. Here is mine. It seems valuable to give less weight to thoughts as they flow in and out of the mind. It is so easy to get lost in that river. The first time meditating feels like standing in the way of a flood. And even as you see it coming, you cannot prepare for the onslaught. To sit still, thinking, breath, 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 I am breathing, and finding myself impressed by the number of thoughts I can think in the space of a breath. 100. And what are the spaces in between my breath? There lies 1,000 thoughts, or one, depending on the day. They just keep coming, flies buzzing. I notice one and it goes away, can't see a single thought alone. It only seems to exist in the cloud. Thank you for listening.
Nice, I liked yours.
Yeah, thoughts. Those thoughts. I like how you went for like the tangible, the body, the architecture, and you went more like philosophical, and then I went like fluffy new age meditating. And like part of the joy of river writing is there's not really judgment or commentary on the writing, but it's kind of fun to talk about it sometimes.
Yeah, and I feel like if you do know the person that's writing, I feel like you can definitely recognize them in their writing. Like, I mean, obviously I've heard a number of your pieces now, and anytime I hear them, I'm always like, oh, this really sounds like a Swan piece.
That's something even in like high school and college I got a lot, is people would be like, oh, you write how you speak. And I was like, well, don't we all? And they're like, well, yeah, but like you actually do. And so that's like reinforcing that statement, and I still don't know what that means. Thank you.
It's a good thing, I would say.
Hopefully people appreciate the way I talk. I do have a radio show. I was curious when we talked about doing the show, and you mentioned architecture in libraries, because we've got some good ones here. The Brooklyn Library, the first time I saw it was like, what is this place? To describe to those who have not seen it, it's actually designed to be like an open book. And then on the front face, there's these tall pillars with all these gold figurines, like, I don't know, latticed up and down. And it just looks like this strange museum castle thing. And it's the library. It was one of my first explorations of Brooklyn where I discovered that. And then, of course, the New York Public Library has very long, rich history. So,
well, and then there's the Mid Manhattan branch, which has a different reputation than the main branch.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
What is that? I'm not from here, so.
The Mid Manhattan branch is a sleepy branch of the library across the street from the main, the central branch.
Oh.
It's quiet, kind of quiet, covert.
Pretty ugly.
You're kind of, yeah, kind of ugly library. But it has a lovely collection.
Are they connected underground or something, or they're two separate buildings?
No, they're not connected in any physical way other than
one of them's a landmark
street.
And one of them's secret.
One of them's not a landmark.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Learned something new already. How about, I mean, are there any other libraries that come to mind specifically in terms of interesting design or history?
In New York, I think, my local branch library is always kind of a warm memory for me. It's right down the block from my apartment building where I grew up. It's, on 96 between Lexington and Park. I think I, over the course of my childhood, checked out every book on trains that there was to check out.
You like trains?
Yeah.
Everything to do with trains?
Yeah.
Have you ever ridden on a train? That's a silly question.
Yeah, many times.
What's a train?
What is a train? No, I'm teasing. That's a wonderful fascination to have. I guess I can ask you, because I don't know and you might know, are trains dying or are they still like going strong?
It's hard to say. It seems like trains, along with a lot of other infrastructure in the United States, are kind of sort of in a state of decline.
Mm-hmm.
But there definitely is interest, I think, with Hyperloop 1 in California, which is being kind of piloted in the Middle East now.
Like reviving a public interest in trains.
Yeah. I mean, it's such an expedient mode of transit that it seems like even architects, one of the architects that's working with engineers on Hyperloop One is Bjarke Engels, and he's a Danish designer. He's currently working on the Hyperloop One stuff.
Can you explain, because I'm sure not everyone knows what Hyperloop One is.
Yeah, we don't live we don't live on the West Coast.
Yeah, come on.
What are they doing over there? Who cares?
It's growing avocados.
Well, I can't explain the technical how Hyperloop One really works, but it's a super high speed. It's kind of like rail, but it's the car. It's not really a car. It's more like a capsule in a tube, and it's shot kind of at super high speeds between cities.
Ooh. So similar to like a Japanese bullet train, or entirely different?
Well, I mean the concept is similar, but the engineering is different.
Hmm. My exposure to trains has to do more with I don't want to say 60s, but just like hopping frights and like such. I mean, the people I know about this because I befriended some people who were doing it and then talked about how it's still something that's done, but that changed a lot over the past 20, 30 years.
Do you know why?
More regulations. I think that's the big one. It's just harder. I mean, it used to be, apparently you could walk onto the freight yard and be like, hey, I'm trying to go this direction. They'd be like, I didn't tell you this, but get on that train, you know? And now it's like, if they see you, they will arrest you. So I think, yeah, just something policy wise and like socially changed about trains.
Yeah. Kind of an obsession with security.
It is a deviant. it on some level, it's an act of deviance to hop on a freight train and get a legal passage from, you know, one place to another. But there's also the whole, like, I don't know, it's not the beatnik, but it's just like this, like, blasé, like, I'll get on this train and I'll land where I land. Like, I'm not making plans. I'm just being carried, you know? Mm-hmm. That kind of an attitude. Jack Kerouac stuff, I guess. Mm-hmm. I have an interesting library story. Mm-hmm. So in Salt Lake, they redid the library, but they did it. But they kind of copied, is it the Vancouver Library? Yes. And so it was funny because everyone was oohing and aahing, and then it was like, oh wait, there's already a very similar library that exists in the world. And I'm not sure how common that is, but it was created. And it's just, I've seen it, a lot of it is glass, so that it's beautiful in the sense that there's nice lines and then a lot of natural light inside the building. But I was curious if you had heard of the designer. He paired up with a branch, like an architecture firm in Utah, but it was the, oh shucks, I gotta find it. This is where I'm not. I had it pulled up and then I can't find the spot where it actually talks about the.
It's okay. I'm still thinking about train. So if you want to look for it, I can. I like trains too.
Just riff on train. Oh, the firm Moshe Safdi and Associates.
Moshe Safdi, yeah.
Yeah, I was hoping I'd say that relatively, like, so you could even recognize it. So that's good. And the circle in my experience connects when I saw him speak at the Boston Book Festival 2 years ago. And for me, that, like, kind of blew my mind. He talks a lot about, like, fractalization of tall buildings and designing, I don't know, in a way that's more attuned to the environment, which is kind of nothing new, but also kind of revolutionary in the age of high-rises. You could probably talk about it more than I could, my limited experience.
Well, what was your experience with the library?
So that was a branch that for me, it's more like an emotional story. That was the branch as a kid. I was always like, someday I'm going to have a library card for that library. Because I was on the fringes, and in Utah, they don't have, like, a connected library system. It's interesting because all the outer cities are connected, but Salt Lake City is separate. And then when I lived in Salt Lake, the first thing I did was get a library card there, and I was finally like, all these books are mine! So, yeah, I would just go and spend hours finding books, reading books, writing. It was, you know, I'm one of those children that the library has always been the home away from home, like the place where you can go, except on holidays.
The home you can always go to, except when it's closed.
Except when they aren't there.
Well, that's the wonderful thing about the library, right, is that the physical space of the library lets you encounter all this, like, adjacent knowledge to the things that you're trying to find just because of the way that the books are organized. So you have all of these...
Especially the nonfiction. As you're walking to find out about trains, you might find who knows what else.
Yeah, you have, find all this serendipitous information.
Yeah. So was your experience with Moshe Safdie? How do you say his name? Moshe Safdie.
I don't have a ton of experience with him. And his design. I think for the most part, my experience is with his like housing that he did for the Montreal Expo.
Okay, yeah.
And it's a pixelated scheme, which is basically a bunch of, like, it looks like a stack of cubes.
Mm-hmm.
I think it seems to me that that's kind of his interest, is in the aggregation of small parts.
Yeah, he likes breaking things apart, which is hella expensive, but I mean, I suppose for me it makes me think of who's the Frank Lloyd Wright, and how he was like an advocate of incorporating like the elements in a lot of his design, and I feel like this is maybe like the age of technology version of that, of like, let's make buildings more organic and break things up and push like crossover, you know, multifunction buildings that will have like residential and retail and like push different classes together. So it's kind of a social experiment from what I understand.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of notions of organicism that you encounter in the discourse of architecture. One is a kind of like looks like organicism, where something looks like a tree or it looks like a leaf. And then the other type is an organicism that may look nothing like a tree, but that acts like a tree. So there are two things that you encounter that architects are looking at different models of the organic that are either looking like or acting like
something
organic, like a system.
Like a frame versus a function? Like, this looks like something is what you're saying versus this acts like something, behaves like something.
Like something that has the, like one version of organicism would be a type of city planning that has the capacities to follow the contours of a river. And that would be a kind of like acts like organicism. And another would be like, this building has a spine that looks like a bird. Or it looks like the skeleton of a bird.
The whale building is the whalebone.
Yeah,
building,
you know, the
downtown
Fulton Street station.
Yeah,
yeah.
A little bit apparatus in its existence, but it's a train station that architecture looks like, I don't know, like bones, like a spine sticking out, and
yeah, that's a Santiago Calatrava piece. He's a Spanish architect, engineer.
I suppose you'd have to be both, maybe, to build that, to conceptualize like the mechanics of it. I don't know. Well, I'm curious about some of your architectural mentors. Like, what kinds of? Well, Chris might have some questions too that are not related to this, but for me, that was what I was curious about. Is maybe like, you know, architects that you admire and like to read about, or who you really like their philosophy or perspective, or maybe you just create your own stuff. I don't know.
No, I mean, I'm definitely always looking to, I think one of the things that we do a lot in school is look at precedents. So in the way that a lawyer would look at a precedent case to understand how to make a decision or some sort of moral code. Architects are constantly looking at deep catalogs of things at the scale of the city to things the scale of a spoon, to understand how form works or how form, like social form or physical form, so how form works or how form is made, different processes. It's hard to pick one.
Well, maybe I can rephrase my question. So, this is just like furthering my radio persona, but I became enamored with like the tiny house movement and like the sustainable housing. Is there like a movement or like a philosophy that you feel is relevant or that you kind of adhere to when you're designing things? Maybe you're referencing back of like, these are the values that I have in architecture and design.
That's a good question. I think that, especially where I am in university, we're dealing with the legacy of modernism. And the way that I've been confronting that recently is by looking at the relational aesthetics movement in art practices since about 1990, how artists are using different installations in order to produce and to call attention to interactions between people that would otherwise be kind of overlooked, and to decontextualize those in a kind of gallery setting in order to sort of call attention to the nuances of interactions between small contingencies of people. So I think that's kind of the movement that I'm observing right now in order to think about space and people.
I might be dense. So for me, I'm hearing is that you kind of think about the people and the place, like when you think of the places you're designing, you more envision like the people and the interactions that it's going to facilitate. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it.
Good. I'm maybe not as dense as I thought I was. Any thoughts?
I was still just kind of wondering what got you interested in architecture in the first place.
Oh.
How did you become this?
How long do you have? I think
we have a while.
We have time. I'm just kidding.
I think the version that I think makes the most sense now is that I've kind of always been interested in imagining and reimagining the spaces that I've inhabited from my room to, say, Central Park when I was growing up there.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of kids grow up with that imagination and having access to that kind of ability to envision a space as something other than it is or to perceive the space that you're in and kind of perceive the richness of that space and either have the kind of this moment where you are wanting to act on that space that you're inhabiting or just that you're feeling the kind of fullness of that space. And at a certain point in my high school career, I was in an AP calculus class.
Mm-hmm.
And after the curriculum had ended, my math teacher, Mr. DeLulo, decided to turn the class into an applied mathematics class. And one of the things that we started to look at was we started doing site visits to nearby buildings. And
which in New York, I'm sure there's
a couple.
Yeah, it was abundant. My high school was right behind Lincoln Center.
Oh, wow.
On 61st Street. So the first couple of site visits that we did were to Lincoln Center and to what was then newly built Time Warner Center on 59th, right around Columbus Circle.
Okay.
And we did a walkthrough of those buildings, and he was explaining what sort of mathematic principles that we had just covered as mm-hmm. part of the standard curriculum were sort of underlying the form or the shape of certain spaces or the shape of the volume of the buildings that we were mm-hmm. looking at. And that's when I realized that architecture was something...
Like people did that for a living. They applied their math and made things.
Right. Yeah. And I think some of that was an acknowledgement of engineering as something that I could do, but also a sudden awareness that people were dealing with the spaces that we live in a really immediate way. And that was really interesting to me.
So kind of the word architect kind of arose in high school, and you were like, oh, that's a thing.
Yeah.
And was it a moment, one of those aha moments of like, okay, this is the path, or was it something that you were holding maybe like as a possibility for years?
I think it was kind of an aha moment. I definitely had always had tendencies that may have been sort of tells for anyone who was observing me from the outside that like this kid might eventually be interested in architecture. Like,
lots of Lego blocks.
Yeah, lots of Lego blocks, an obsession with like cardboard and wood blocks, like interest in shop class and constant like making. So,
should we pause?
Yeah, we can pause.
Well, and that leads me into your multidisciplinary approach. It's something that it seems featured on your website. And I was just curious if you want to talk a little bit about how that overlap of design, photography, and architecture like feeds into one another or other things.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the work that I was doing, especially in undergrad, was an art practice. So photography, sculpture, and drawing. And printmaking.
Okay. Middlebury.
Yeah, Middlebury is...
You have lots of options.
Yeah, it's liberal arts for sure. So I had a lot of exposure to different disciplines.
Did you take any away? Are you still actively practicing any of those? Or it was a moment? Is that me?
Well, some of those are harder than others.
You don't have a printmaking workshop in your house?
Yeah, I don't have like an intaglio press around anymore. But
can you call yourself a true creative?
I hope so.
Do you think? Well, because I mean, I feel like especially when it comes to like the tactile creative things, that it's something that kids do, but at some point they stop doing. And the people who become artists, quote unquote, or not quote unquote, I guess, people who become artists are the people that just never stopped doing those things. So I was just curious if you actively were painting or sculpting in your life now on the side.
Well, I think all of those techniques are, yeah, they kind of get spun into the way that I practice. Whether it's, you know, painting small watercolors in a sketchbook or drawing with pen or, I still work with my hands a lot. And I mean, me and my colleagues all work with our hands a lot, making sketch models and, building things, consistently so that we can see or feel how things will look and, see how things will feel, and how, you know, a certain, space will take light.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think a lot of what I was doing in undergrad as well was composition. So, when it comes to, we do a lot of graphic design and architecture, choosing colors for our layouts and our drawings mm-hmm. and, choosing a style to produce a visualization of a building in order to conjure the right affect for that space.
Right. You're presenting to clients. You want something that's going to look great.
Yeah. Well, not yet to clients, but to each other and to our peers and to our professors.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're constantly developing and working with a thesis when we're designing buildings about space or about program. By program, I mean like activity or how we envision the space being used.
Mm-hmm.
So we're constantly developing theses to describe how we imagine these spaces will be and how they'll be used. And so we're constantly testing those theses by producing different visualizations.
As an architect, you're encountering problems to solve or like roles to fill. Are there things that you do that foster a flow of creativity? So if you're like stuck on something, is there something that like I'm asking for your tricks, I guess. Are there things that for you help you kind of get into a different way of thinking to solve a problem?
I mean, I think I have a couple of different techniques. One is like constantly moving. I guess I'm kind of like a shark that needs to pass water mm-hmm. over its gills.
No,
but,
that's a thing.
I get up a lot and I take a lot of walks around campus, either by myself or with colleagues sometimes it's just going to get coffee, but sometimes it's actually like a walking meditation where I'm just kind of thinking through something or trying to clear my mind so that when I get back, I can look at a drawing and say, oh, that's something that I was missing before. And this is something that I can do that will change this thing and make it better.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is just to iterate a lot. and when you have enough options of things, then you start to be able to qualify the things that you're doing and be able to say, these are like 500 things that I've done, and this group of 10 things is good, this group of 10 things is bad. And I have a thesis that says, like, these things are good and these things are bad.
Hmm. Interesting. What were the things?
It could just be, like, a particular arrangement of walls or something like that. It's like, because of the way that these walls are shaped or are arranged in relation to one another, this will do a specific thing to the people who are walking between these walls. And because of what I've said about how people will walk through this space, this wall shape doesn't work where this wall shape does work.
So bad, good.
Yeah.
Nice.
Bad wall. Bad.
Bad.
But we always catalog all the, I shouldn't say bad or good, but...
Works better.
Yeah. And sometimes I'll come back to something that I've discarded. I'm sort of constantly cataloging things. So that, sometimes...
You never know when it's going to come up and be quote-unquote good.
Yeah, quote
or
unquote
be
good.
The right thing for that space and for the way that people are interacting with it.
Yeah.
Nice. I have one last question. It's very pressing. Is there a style of architecture that you feel lends itself more readily to Christmas decor?
Christmas decor.
Don't you mean holiday decor?
Holiday decor.
Holiday decor.
Thank you.
I don't know. I mean, holiday decor is sort of ornamentation. So if we're thinking in a kind of modernist way, then especially if you're talking about figures like Adolf Loos, he was an Austrian guy who said ornament is crime. any Christmas ornament might just be too much
criminal.
It might just be
it's detracting from the architecture.
Too much frosting on the cake. Whereas for maybe a postmodernist, you'd want to have as many kitsch, sort of like Christmas paraphernalia or holiday paraphernalia everywhere.
So it's an aesthetic style.
Yeah.
That's what you're telling me. Everyone has their own approach.
But maybe if you are thinking of a more Baroque kind of Christmas. Yeah. Feel, then probably postmodernism is most readily adapted to a kind of
Baroque Christmas feel.
Yeah.
Holiday feel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. I was worried and now I know.
We're all good then.
If you just tuned in, we've been talking to Evio Isaac and this is Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. Check out our communities. We're online, Ink and Worm and Radio Free Brooklyn.
I was just kind of curious if you consider architecture art, because I've noticed a lot of times both like in textbooks and college programs and elsewhere, a lot of times they're positioned as art and architecture. I was just kind of curious if you do you think it's art or not? If so, why not?
I guess in a technical sense, architecture maybe wants to be autonomous from art because it's seen as a profession, mm-hmm. That you have to be licensed to practice. So in a sort of strictly technical sense, architecture probably wants to exist outside of art, and speaking generally.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think architecture is such an integrated practice that it's hard to categorize in a kind of simple way, because the architect is a kind of intermediary between many, many disciplines. So an architect is doing a lot of things, communicating the design intent of a client, translating certain goals that design goals and programmatic goals that a client may have about a particular space, and translating that into kind of physical form.
Yeah.
And communicating that to the people who are going to build it. But also mediating between all the fields that are providing products for that project, and dealing with budget, dealing with matters of liability, and taking on a lot of the liability of a building.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's hard to categorize.
I would say that actually a lot of what you just said sounded to me like film. Because film sort of works the same way, and you have like a lot of different moving parts, and you have different, you know, you have creative writing with a screenwriter, like you have you sort of have similar architecture going on with like production design, you know, like building sets and whatnot, and then you have acting, and then you have this director who needs to like manage all these different aspects. I guess the one big difference at the end of the day is like the film is still most, or like your average film is really just serving still like a entertainment purpose, versus like a building at the end of the day has like usually serving some kind of utilitarian purpose, even if it's designed in a particular fashion.
Yeah. I mean, in a very basic way, it has to stand up.
Yeah. Generally.
Yeah. Hopefully.
Unless it's an art piece. Like, no one's allowed inside.
Yeah.
It's not stable. That makes me think of a question I'm going to recycle from a designer friend that I have, who talks about how architects used to have to draw a lot more than they do now, and how he feels like there should still be a screening process. And that if you don't have like an artistic, you know, aesthetic, that maybe architecture isn't something you should pursue. Hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
That's
a pretty strong position.
Yeah, it is a pretty strong position. I would say that, I mean, we still have to draw a lot as a means of communicating.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like you hear the kind of like, the story of the napkin sketch. That an architect, you know, shows up at a client meeting, and the client says all these things, and the architect, the kind of genius architect pulls out a napkin. And they're sitting at a bar, and the architect takes a kind of like a thick black pen out and gesturally, produces something that is
on a napkin.
And I mean, the most impressive way to do this is to draw upside down, so you're drawing like in perspective, but mm-hmm. so that the client can see and you're facing
that,
the other
isn't
way.
Isn't that the whole like philosophy behind drawing on the left side of the brain, is like drawing upside down? Anyways, continue. So you can draw upside down, which is quite the skill. Everyone has it, and it's pretty impressive to see it.
I think maybe we do less analog drawing than the draftsman typically did in, you know, before computer-aided drafting came about.
But yeah.
There's still a tremendous amount of drafting that happens on the computer. And, those skills haven't changed, but the tools are different.
Right.
And the precision is greater.
Well, it makes me think that it's almost an applicable answer to Chris's question, in the sense of, like, are you an artist or are you not? How do you categorize? And it's like, well, we do all these things that are different, but also on a basic level, like, there's an aesthetic to it. There's being not only to like visualize a space, but to translate that into a plan that could then be built, mm-hmm. you know, in a way that's functional, but also achieves the vision.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I guess one of the other things that we're confronting now is like parametricism.
What is that?
Which is
oh yeah, yes, parametricism. Oh my gosh, I was just reading an article about that.
Well, yeah. So parametricism, I use that so cavalierly. Parametricism is basically that you're dealing with a set of numerous parameters, and that let's say you have a sort of like strangely shaped building. In order to produce the cladding for that building, you need to be able to panelize the shape into many smaller pixels.
Separate places that you can work with?
Imagine like taking, it's kind of like pattern making in fashion.
Okay.
So in order to produce a garment, you have to be able to produce all the pieces that you can sew together to produce that garment, or to be able to unroll the three-dimensional garment and then cut that pattern out.
Okay.
So parametricism does a sort of similar thing where it's sort of cutting up I guess you can see it as a kind of
space
fabric,
or building?
But not a space, more like the envelope, because I think that's where it's the most evident.
Huh.
But that you're able to cut that envelope up into small enough pieces that then you can manufacture and label and then install.
So that's almost like there's been a movement towards pre-manufactured houses and stuff, which isn't new per se, but the technology behind it is changing. Mm-hmm. Is that related?
You could definitely have a prefabricated parametric house.
Yeah, those exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you're referring to it more in like a larger usage, not like a single house?
Well, I guess I'm talking about it as an alternative to the artist architect
dilemma,
who's like sketching something and then turning that sketch over to draftsmen or draftspeople.
Okay.
I guess the most contemporary way to refer to people who do drawings are just designers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's so broad.
Yeah,
I'm
so
a designer.
Broad.
That could mean anything.
They're all valuable. Yeah, that's just to say draftsman is like a dated term.
It's not yeah,
I
yeah.
like draftsman.
Well, I mean, but in the course of like architecture, designers are functionally like the pre-architect, like the person that draws everything up, and then it has to be, you know, vetted, cleared through someone who has the education, in my mind.
Right.
So, like, a lot of people are doing architectural work or very similar, like, the drafts work, the laying down of the groundwork in design, mm-hmm. and then it moves from there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, architecture is such a broad... I guess I'm trying to double back to the original prompt, which is the question that you asked, that you were talking about with the designer friend that you have.
Yeah,
about,
should you have to be able to draw?
Right. And architecture is just such a broad field that, I mean, there are architects who...
draw upside down on a napkin,
right,
but they're
yeah.
wonderful architects.
Right, yeah. Are wonderful at the type of architecture that they do.
And the tools they have.
Right. So
I keep putting words in your mouth right now. Like, you said this, right? Wait, I said that.
Yeah, I mean, some architects are drafting buildings, and some architects are vetting those drawings of buildings. So some architects just expedite plan drawings for like landmarks. So they're not actually doing any of the technical, mm-hmm. they're not doing any of the conceptual design, but they're receiving a set of drawings from another firm.
Or in some sense, like maybe creating a vision and somebody actualizes it versus you doing that work.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
they're both
some
valuable
firms...
because I mean, yeah, it's like a partnership of skills sets.
Sounds like filmmaking again. In a good way. I mean.
Everything sounds like filmmaking. What are you, a film major?
Maybe. I was also thinking about, as we were saying before, like architecture has at the end of the day has a very utilitarian purpose. And I think as a quote-unquote layperson, it's easy to just think of architecture sort of purely just as like, these are buildings that, you know, I live in and work in and whatnot. So how do you think that lay people can better appreciate architecture?
I have a story. You live in Texas. I think 3 years ago, it got so hot there that foundations were cracking. And that sounds like a design flaw, but it's also like an extreme temperature that wasn't foreseen. Obviously, those people suddenly started caring about their foundations, right?
Yeah, I guess that's still like, caring about architecture in a utilitarian way. I guess like
rather than just valuing something because it's architecturally well done.
Yeah, I guess just like how can, like, do you think the same way that we can get the average person to move beyond looking at architecture as merely just being a building and something more artistic with an aesthetic? Like how can there be greater like architectural literacy, if you want to put it that way?
Well, I mean, I think on a daily basis, I mean, we're always in touch with architecture. Some really good architecture is really good because of its ability to almost disappear.
Yeah.
And operate in the background while the activities that are happening inside are foregrounded. So in that sense, there are some spaces that we view as utilitarian that are really simple spaces that which we aren't even necessarily very conscious of, but that that their effect is to foreground what sort of activities and interactions are happening inside. And then there's other great architecture which is acting in that way, and then also has moments where suddenly you become very aware of the design of a space, whether that's a moment like in an office space, maybe the space of labor is very open and you're able to interface with all of your coworkers in a really open and easy way. But there might be a breakout space or a kind of like fishbowl that is a significant break from the kind mm-hmm. of monotony of or
being
kind
exposed
of rigor,
all the
yeah,
time.
The rigor of like an open office plan.
Well, like what you're saying about architecture, you know, almost disappearing into the background. It makes me feel like while it's not appreciated, like that is its goal. Because then I don't know. In some senses, I guess it depends on what we're talking about. There's a lot of museums that are beautiful, and
I mean, I would also
if
give,
you don't notice, shame on you.
Yeah, like, I would give more credit to the quote-unquote layperson having a kind of innate sense of space, and even if it's quote-unquote taken for granted, it's still something tangible and something that we're. There's an innate literacy, I would say, that people have of space. There are technical things that we can read, like there's a kind of like phenomena of like if one wall is colder than another wall, you can sense the differential and it makes you uncomfortable in a space.
Ooh,
so that's
weird.
A kind of like basic
well, how
literacy.
Does that play into like radiant heating?
Huh?
Like radiant heating, isn't that heating in the floor? So it comes from the floor up, but like that doesn't do a similar thing.
I think it's more. It's
you're like
more
my toes
even.
Are warm. That's all I care about.
Yeah. Well, and it's a kind of even distribution.
After,
I think it's,
yeah.
it's more extreme it's not... in terms of like feeling as like a loss of equilibrium when like one wall is really cold,
like
and
maybe exposed to the
cold.
Sun or exposed like not well insulated as opposed
yeah.
to the
like
other.
If you're in an office in the winter in a like glazed. Space and you're sitting next to the window and then like the other half of your space is really warm but the window's really cold,
you will become a crazy person.
So that's a kind of basic literacy.
So that's a legitimate complaint to bring up in your next work meeting. Well, let's switch gears here a little bit. We're gonna move into our segment where we ask you questions really fast.
Oh, man.
And
okay.
You can answer fast or answer slow, and we might answer some, too.
Sure.
Since this is going to be our new kind of New Year crossover episode, are there any New Year traditions you have? How do you feel about New Year's resolutions, kind of reflecting on the past, looking on the future, or does that not exist for you? Because
no.
It doesn't exist for me. Sometimes I'm like, I have a word, because that's all I can manage.
New Year's traditions, I would say I never go out for New Year's. I always spend New Year's at home.
Because it's scary. All the people are out.
Well, yeah. I don't know if it's scary, but...
I'm scared.
I never go to, like, Times Square.
Parties.
I never go to Times Square.
It doesn't matter what day it is.
Yeah, me neither.
But it's so nice.
Kind of avoid at all costs.
Favorite part of the city. But no, I mean, I think... I don't know. Maybe I would call myself a pretty nostalgic person, so I don't need New Year's as an occasion, a special occasion to reflect and be self-aware. I think it's a pretty
normal. You're already
normal...
doing that on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Nice. Chris, traditions, reflections.
I mean, really, the only like. I just tend to have ongoing plans, so really the only thing that I have timed with a new year is my my financial savings goals, which is a little boring, but
so
you
boring.
Know, it's good to be on track, and I am, so I feel pretty good about that.
Yeah. I obviously have some goals at some point in time, otherwise I wouldn't be here now, but I like to pick a word for the year, so this year has been nurture. And I think my word for next year is going to be curiosity. So for me, that's like a very vague concept that I can check in on. Chris, do you have a question?
Yeah. Do you have a favorite piece of architecture in New York City?
Favorite piece of architecture in New York City.
And do you call them pieces of architecture?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, you can just call them buildings.
Buildings?
Yeah. I don't want to say building.
Building.
What a layperson term.
Yeah, for sure. I think one of my favorite buildings actually is near completion now, is a building by a Swiss firm, Herzog & Demeron. It's downtown. It's called 56 Leonard.
Which one is that?
It looks like a typical tower at the base, and then at the top it starts to become more and more pixelated.
Hmm.
You may have seen it. It's sort of... I mean, it just looks like it was hit with like a ray gun that made the top part into 8-bit, and the bottom part
all
is
the penthouses
like...
have more windows.
Yeah, the bottom is like 4K, and the top part is like you know, like Nintendo
140p.
Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah, I think that's a really great building.
Mm.
It's pretty neat, and I don't know. I think one of my other favorite buildings is probably the new museum on the Bowery.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Chris, do you have a favorite piece of architecture?
What's your favorite piece of architecture?
Obviously, the Midtown Library. I mean, I always really love the Museum of Natural History. I think it's much for what's inside it, but I do love the way the building itself is designed. It fits its subject matter perfectly.
Yeah, well, it's kind of piecemeal, and I don't know. I love the new planetarium. It's
yeah,
pretty sweet.
the new addition too. But I guess I was thinking more of the traditional museum, just those huge ceilings and
marble.
Yeah, and the long hallways and
the whale room.
Yeah, obviously the whale room
and all the exhibits. mine's not a piece of architecture. It's a park. I like Prospect Park. Mm. So I mean. It's not a building, but I guess it's a piece of architecture, but that's not a building.
Would a park qualify as architecture?
Yeah.
You design it.
Somebody designed it. Yeah.
Ha ha.
Yeah.
Dang.
Foiled again. Same designer as a Central Park.
My next question has nothing to do with anything we've been talking about. Do you have a current addiction when it comes to streaming, podcasts, Netflix?
Podcasts. I listen to a lot of Planet Money, and I just started Crime Town,
mm-hmm.
which is, The current season is about Providence, Rhode Island. I haven't gotten very far in, but I just listened to the first episode and it's really super interesting. So, Crime Town. Oh, and Invisibilia.
That's amazing. I like that one. Yes.
What's that?
So great.
Yeah, it's about the kind of invisible like tendencies that shape the way that we behave
forces.
And interact. Yeah.
It's always so mysterious, but then they're like, but this is like happening.
Yeah.
And here, 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 and here. And you're like, whoa.
Yeah.
Pretty much that's one of the podcasts that I like end, and then I have to just like sit down for 5 minutes and like, what did I just. Like my worldview has changed a little bit in ways I don't fully understand.
Sounds interesting.
Chris, what is your addiction lately?
I mean, I always like nature documentaries and Netflix. So yeah, anything like, I mean, pretty much anything the BBC produces, I'm usually pretty happy to watch.
I think the only thing I watched in its entirety recently is Bob's Burgers, and I watched the second half of Rogue One. So that's what I've got going for me. I guess maybe the last third.
First half was pretty shabby, though.
I got the good part.
Yeah.
I think one more question.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Oh,
make it a good one.
Do you have any like books about architecture that you would recommend?
Books about architecture. well, it's not directly about architecture, but I would recommend the book Hyperobjects by Timothy O. Morton. It's a pretty awesome book. I mean, I think it has to do with architecture, definitely ideas that architects are thinking about.
Yeah,
but it's kind of about systems that are bigger than the field of our perception that are kind of operating in the background. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, that sounds neat. I'm on board. Maybe I can find it at the Midtown Library.
Maybe.
I was looking in my phone to try and find my words so that I could end my show with a word.
Words would be good.
Sometimes it's hard.
It's okay. Any other books?
Well, I mean,
have you read any other books?
The Fountainhead is not, it's not an architecture book, but it's about an architect. It's about much more than architecture, but.
I have a question related to books. Did you get any books for Christmas that you're excited about?
Did I get any books for Christmas? Not yet. I'm hoping that I will get a book by one of my professors called Seamless Digital, and it's a book that is, it talks about a certain representational style which a lot of architects use, which is the kind of photographic collage.
Interesting. So listeners can check it out. Thanks for listening. This is Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn, and I'll leave you with a word, take it or leave it. Snifters.